started. Thank you all for coming to this particular session. I know there was a looming thunderstorm. Oh,
microphone, guys.
Thumbs up. I'm kind of. Can you hear? Oh, I see. There's an echo in my ear. Hello. Okay, the mic should be on. Everybody here? Well, not great, I heard. There's an echo or something. Maybe we want to... Okay, well, this is where they placed it, but shall I move forward with it? Hello, how's that? It's better. All right. I mean, I could just sit here with the little guy and... But it would be not so much fun. How's this? Well, David, do you want to say a word? This, of course, is David Gergen.
Go ahead, please.
But I just want to make sure your mic, we'll do a mic check. It's an echo, right? All right, I'll lean back. How about that? Maybe it's our mics doing something. I'm sort of talking to the sound people, but how's this? Have I stayed leaning back?
It just sounds weird.
I know.
Hey, hey guys, we've still got a problem. Can somebody attend to this?
Is it going to be like that?
Yeah.
It wouldn't help to move this to the other side. Nothing. All right, well, you're going to have to get used to it. But I'm not going to be doing so much of the talking. David is. And, you know, just you know, I know you've all come here, so you have some sense of what we're doing. But I am Renee Montaigne, host of Morning Edition. And this is David Gergen, who, what can I say, Harvard School, Kennedy School, rather, Harvard, Eyewitness to Power, his best-selling book. You hear him, those of you who listen to NPR, you've been hearing him on our air for years and years. Although we have never met, and this is very...
Our voices have met.
Our voices have been going back and forth for half my life, half my working life, I feel like. But this is the first time we just met just over there in the corner. And it was like so easy. I just like know David. So thank you all for coming. And I think the mic's calming down a little bit. My ears tell me.
Let me try. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It's that's the way they're doing it.
Can you turn your chair just a little bit? Is that better? You think it'd be better? Okay.
Look, I'm getting different. All right. Look. All right.
So I want to tell you a story.
I just want.
Can you hear this mic, all right?
Yes.
Well, I do have a sensitivity about this. I went to a corporate dinner. I was speaking in New York not long ago, and before we started, I asked them, the hosts, who's the most memorable speaker you've ever had here? And they said, oh, James Carville by far. And I don't know how many of you know James, but he's very colorful. And I said, but why was he so memorable? And they said, well, he was up in the middle of his speech, of an evening in New York. In the middle of the speech, he says, I've got to pee. And he walks off the stage, disappears, and the worst thing was he never turned his lavalier off. So I'm very sensitive about these lavaliers.
Yeah, you'd remember that.
Yeah, you'd remember that, right?
Sorry, James Carville even remembers.
Yeah.
That's true. Well, what we're going to be talking about tonight is what we, that is America, needs for a president. But, you know, I'd actually like to ask a question that's a little different than that, just to start off, although I have plenty of ideas about that as well, which is, David, do you think in this election, and it's something I would not have thought I would not have applied to any other election in my lifetime, do you think we're going to get the president we deserve?
Yes, actually. I don't think we've had the campaign we deserve. I think this has been one of the worst campaigns that we've all endured, and thankfully it will be over eventually. But I think the chances are that Mrs. Clinton will win, and I think that's closer to the kind of president that people have in mind when they talk about the presidency. And that Donald Trump, people have had a very, very hard time adjusting to what Trump brings to the table, and I'm sure there's widespread dismay here at Aspen about Trump, but I don't think he's going to get elected. Now, I would warn you that it's possible. The Brits didn't think Brexit would pass either. And Donald Trump has just had 4 weeks of the worst campaign I've ever seen by any major candidate. It's been the most destructive period that I've seen. And Hillary Clinton has a much stronger organization. She has much more money in the bank. She fulfills all the normal sort of prerequisites. And she's by far and away one of the most informed people I've ever seen run for the presidency or serve in the presidency. She's an extremely competent woman who is on top of the issues in ways that exceed what I've seen from most candidates. So much so that she actually, I don't know, you saw this little article in the New York Times not long ago, she actually has a position on UFOs, and she's thought about it quite a lot. I mean, it turns out she's a real buff on UFOs and wants to release the papers that the government has been, you know, it's easier to get her to release the UFO papers than it is papers about her own speeches at Goldman Sachs, but be that as it may. So she has a lot going for her. And after all of that, you would think this was a blowout election already, you know, that this was almost over. And the truth is it's not. And the surprise is how close he still is. He remains within striking distance. There's one outlier poll, the Washington Post ABC poll that came out in the last two or three days, that had her up 12. But that is outlier. The range, the average, is now around 6 or 7. But in the battleground states, the critical states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, it's quite close. Now, we'll go on and talk about why I still think she's going to win. I would say he's got about a 20% chance right now, maybe 20, 25% chance. But that is not zero. It's not zero. And we don't know what further developments that we have in store, especially with regard to the investigation into the emails. And I would stress to you, well, I don't know how that's going to come out, but it's not unimportant. It is important that what started as a civil investigation has now turned into a criminal investigation. And there is a rumor here in Aspen that this is all going to come to a head in the next 2 weeks before the Republican convention. We'll have to wait and see, and we'll have to see how it goes. But absent that, I think her chances of winning are very, very high. And in that sense, I think she's very close to the president we deserve.
Well, then let's talk about need, because as long as we've left it with Hillary Clinton for the moment, how can it be that with the attributes that you've just numbered, and they're all true, she's extremely competent, extremely experienced, as some say, the most experienced candidate that America's had, certainly in modern times. Why do so many people not like her, and in a very visceral way? And do we need, if we're going to be just theoretical about this and not be talking about this particular election, a president that people care about?
I think we need a president that people trust.
Well, they don't trust her either.
And they don't trust right now. Majorities don't trust either candidate. Listen, one could have a long, long conversation about leadership and what's required. And leadership so often depends on context. You know, the kind of leadership you need depends a great deal on the context in which you find yourself. 1939, Churchill was washed up, going out of public life. Nobody thought they'd ever hear from him again. They thought he was reckless and compulsive, and he'd made big mistakes in World War I, for which he got a lot of blame. Even though he'd been a member of parliament since 1900, in 1939, people thought he was done for. In 1940, a year later, in May of 1940, when the Germans were marching across Europe and, you know, and everything seemed very, very bleak, he was exactly the man they were looking for. He was exactly the leader they were looking for. So the context changed dramatically, and their needs changed. You know, and John Kerry was here earlier. I'm sure most of you heard him. But he talked about his professor at Yale, John Morton Blum, who was a wonderful historian. And Blum's argument was that politics always responds to perceived or felt needs. And Churchill responded to that felt need. I think Hillary has still got a hill to climb in terms of convincing people she is going to meet their felt needs. She's, to some dramatic degree, Each candidate is trying to win now by demonizing the other candidate. Vote for me because I'm not that schmuck over there, or that criminal over there, or that fraud over there. And candidates usually, you know, run on the future, not just to get. Not you obviously want to run against your opponent, but you run on the future. You remember Bill Clinton's the song he had, you know, "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow." That was his campaign song back in 1992, and she needs to have more of that uplift. That focuses on what the country needs.
But also with Donald Trump, he seems to be giving the people who are you know, support him, the sense that he's somebody that's needed. He's the man of the hour. He's a guy who speaks, if not the truth, he speaks what he says what he means.
I do. I think he does respond to the felt need of a portion of the population, a significant portion of the population. But it's worth remembering that he got 40% of the primary voters of the votes in the primaries, the Republican primaries. That was 30 million votes. In this general election, they're expected to be 130 million people voting. So, you know, that's a long, having 40% of 30 is a long, long way from having 50% of 130. So, he's got to convince a lot of people still that he's the right person. But to go back to John Secretary Kerry's appearance and what we've been talking about all weekend, there are two things going on around the world that are showing up here as well as in other countries. The first is this rise of populist movements that we saw in Brexit, but you can see with Le Pen in France, you can see in Germany, you can see in Hungary, in Poland. There are a number of other countries where this is all going on and these populist movements are growing up and taking hold. Usually in these countries, they represent about 25 to 30% of the electorate. And Le Pen is heading toward more, but that's been their base. And Donald Trump's still got to prove he can get beyond that base. But the second thing that's going on, not only in the populist movement countries, but in many other significant countries as well, is there is a sense of unrest, of unease, insecurity, volatility. You know, the world is not certain. And people are looking for greater certainty. You know, at West Point, they now teach the cadets in terms of talking to them about what kind of future they'll have as young officers, what kind of world they're going into. They use an acronym of VUCA, V-U-C-A. And it stands for volatility, uncertainty, chaos, and ambiguity. VUCA. And you see that now across much of the world. How do people respond to that? What's the perceived need? They look for strength. They look for strong men. Mm-hmm. And we've had the rise of Caesarism in effect in much of the world. And look at the big countries. Russia, obviously, has gone down that path. But now China is. The regime there is getting increasingly authoritarian. India, Modi, has become really authoritarian. I was with the head of the Ford Foundation not long ago and a nonprofit session, and he had to rush that night. The head of the Ford Foundation had to go to India to protect his people working for nonprofits in India. Who would have thought, you know, where we've sent so many nonprofit people? But the government was cracking down on Indian nationals who were working for the Ford Foundation in India, were trying to fly to some international conference, wouldn't let them get on airplanes. And he had to go in. So you've got those three big countries, but look at Turkey. With Erdogan, look at Egypt, look at now in the Philippines. That's what Trump represents to a lot of Americans. He represents that kind of strong man a lot of Americans who feel left out or marginalized are responding to, and that has given our politics this enormous uncertainty and feeling like, is this the same country we used to live in? And a lot of people feel no. That doesn't mean he wins. It just means there's a threat there to the normal order. And, you know, in the long run, it may be a wake-up call to those of us in the elites who, frankly, need to get our act together.
I would suggest it probably is, though. But how, it would be the question. I mean, Brexit, obviously, it was an example of people who just didn't. They were voting as much against the elite and experts.
Absolutely.
It was coming out in polls. I mean, people were saying this in our ear. They didn't trust experts. People have sort of come to a point where they don't trust experts to know what they're talking about, or at least they don't feel that they've got their best interests at heart.
Right. So those of you who came here on Sunday for the opening will remember that Christine Lagarde spoke. She was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And she on her plate are most of the big economic problems of growth and now Brexit. But she said her biggest worry was the fact that experts no longer commanded the trust and belief. And instead, there are so many citizens in so many countries are turning to anti-intellectual type leaders.
Well, one of the other responses, I think you've all been hearing about Brexit for days now, but one of the other responses that I found very interesting was that people also said that they not only didn't believe what people were telling them, but but that this was the most, British politicians said this was the most untruthful campaign. Not just vicious, they're pretty good at being vicious over there too, but the most untruthful campaign they had ever seen, because I'm not sure on both sides, but certainly with the Brexit numbers, they were really easy to debunk about what you had to pay out to the EU, what Great Britain had to pay, what it was getting back in return, when in fact it's a little like California, where I come from, which is where you more money goes to the federal government than comes back to the state. Yeah. And it was great during Sarah Palin's time when, so much money was going to Alaska and they were so proud that, get the government off our back.
But to go to the point about, go back to Trump, 2 weeks before the vote in England, Trump was asked at a press conference, what do you think of Brexit? And he said, what? And I said, Brexit. And he said, I don't know much about that. And then it was explained to him. He said, I guess I ought to get out.
Sounds good.
Well, sort of Brexit voters made Donald Trump, right? And there is something to that. But let's have a quick detour. So how is it, what is it behind NPR that makes it so believable? Because somehow NPR as a brand, you may agree or disagree with the point of view, but it's very believed.
Well, I mean, we try and tell the truth. I mean, we make mistakes, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And I know we're accused. Well, listen, I've been there so long. There
was National People's Radio, right?
National People's Radio, National. This is during the Sandinistas. It was something like National Public Radio, or would have been National Sandinista Radio. I mean, any one of those. Yeah. They don't apply so much anymore because, for one thing, everyone's 20 years older and everyone has mortgages now. And so people have gotten more middle of the road, definitely more middle of the road, but also more serious. Yeah. Journalism is much more serious. I don't want to knock the early days because, of course, you had people like Linda and Cokie who are already here doing amazing work. But we still honor.
But you must
tradition.
Have a pretty vigorous editing
and
process.
We do. But, I'll tell you something. We're doing a lot more live during the show on Morning Edition. It's a change in direction, partly for intended, and partly just circumstantial because of the because we're more involved in getting out there. As you might have noticed, any of you listen to Morning Edition, out there on the road during this campaign, and what we have been wrestling with, this just came up a few weeks ago, is you do live interviews with politicians. And interview them at your risk, because the thing is, in a not live interview that you do even an hour before the show, and the show starts at 2 a.m. my time in California, starts at 5 a.m. in D.C. So you do a live interview with any of these folks live, and you're at the mercy of, you better know everything, because the one thing about successful politicians is they're pretty good at using and manipulating, on all sides, by the way, of course, using and manipulating data, numbers, whatnot, and they will end up saying things that you might not have at that exact moment the ability in 5 minutes live to counter. And it's come up a couple of times, and it just gets by. And we've had to take off an interview. You can't really...
Have you actually not put some on the air?
Well, let me think. If you can't follow up and somebody said, it hasn't happened to me, but I know it happened with David Greene, where they went back, and just sorry to say I can't remember exactly what it was, and maybe it wasn't an intentional lie, but it was a misrepresentation. Went back, re-interviewed on the phone, and put in copy that was accurate and had been acknowledged by that interviewee. And if I think of it in the next few minutes, I'll tell you what it was. So it wasn't as stupid, but something. So mainly you don't want to do it yourself. I spend massive amount of time trying to get the background behind every single time I say something like, what's next? Or why do you say that? They may sound like nothing questions, but for anybody I'm preparing to interview, it's because I want to know if what they say is what it really means so that I can then proceed, even in a not live interview.
Well, this relates to the campaign we're going through, because I must tell you, one of the biggest changes that's occurred in my lifetime wandering around in this area is that respect for the truth has declined so much. People are so much less careful than they once were. I in my youth, for all my sins, I actually ran the speech writing and the research arm of the Nixon White House. I was quite young. And we would put out a variety of presidential statements. Every day you're putting out things. And we had a research team of about five people. And the head of the research team had been the head of research for Time Magazine and applied the Time Magazine standards. And what they and for that meant that somebody on the staff had to put a check on top of every word and check it and make sure it verified. This is in the Nixon administration. You know, we had the big lies. We got all the small things right, you know. But what I'm saying is that those days, it was so important to get the truth and get it right. Not only in the campaign, but to get it right if you're in office, because that was sort of the trust. It was so important to running things. And now, you know, increasingly, and this started long before Obama, but increasingly, for people who work in politics and people who work in the White House, the truth is what you can make people believe, is what you can get away with. And you sort of come up with your first response is, let's make up an answer to what happened and see if it flies. If it doesn't fly, you change your story. But if it flies, there you are. Let's go on. Let's go to the next event. That has been a very discouraging part of this. The whole notion that, you know, and it all has to do with spin. And I think spin's gotten out of control. And what you can see in this campaign is that neither side is paying a lot of attention to being careful. And because the rhetoric from Trump has been so exaggerated that the Clinton people have been drawn into that. And now on both sides, you're getting a lot of stuff that's like, where did this all come from? Social media hasn't helped, obviously.
I was going to say, yesterday, I'll tell you where I sourced this. I read it in the New York Times. But yesterday, Donald Trump gave a speech in Pennsylvania, coal country, and his speech was passed out. And it's very unusual for him because he's been extemporaneous, more or less, from the beginning. But he's now doing, this was a prepared speech, and he delivered it pretty straightforwardly. 128 footnotes on what the reporters got.
They gave you 128 footnotes?
I didn't. I wasn't there. But no, they gave apparently
the written speech
that was handed out, because that's very normal. 128 footnotes.
Well, that's good.
To say, you know, yeah. Well, he's on another path now, in theory.
He is for now.
Yeah. So, but social media. I mean, that's so much talked about. Can I say this is really wacky? I'm sure, but I thought of this a few days ago. One of the things that strikes me about this campaign, which may apply to our society increasingly, Donald Trump. Let me just say this simply. I've talked to a lot of people. I ask everybody all the time, you know, my Uber drivers and things like that. And the thing that people keep saying, as I said in the beginning, is Donald Trump says what he means. All right. So what he means, it doesn't always translate to the truth, but he says what he thinks is true and what he means. And that means a lot, you know, that means a lot to people. And I tried to profile him in my own head just so I could stay kind of neutral. And some of it had to do with how popular he was on The Apprentice. And some of that had to do with, which I never really watched, but I did watch in a couple of episodes just to figure it out, that it had to do with him being kind of a character and a persona, and anybody watching kind of understood that. They were on both several layers of the meanness and the fun and the whatever. And I started to have this thought that I feel a little more like we're in Fahrenheit 451 now. And if you remember that novel, what it was people had stopped reading books. But they just didn't stop reading books. And people do read now, so that's really unfair. But people had started watching TV, and reality TV is basically what it was. And, you know, the protagonist guy, Montag, who's easy for me to remember his last name, was upset with his wife because all she wanted to do was watch TV because they were her friends. People on the television she knew better than she knew her own friends, or her and her two girlfriends were always watching television, and this was their social world. I guess like The View or something, if you thought that's who your friends were. And I think there's something about that with Trump. That's all I was going to say. It's not exactly social media. There you get into Twitter.
Yeah.
But it's something like the people who like him and follow him take a lot of what he says in stride. They don't have to be major like racists, because he's like somebody they know.
Yeah, I agree. Listen, let me go back to Hillary just for a while, because I really think it's important to sort of where we are. And, you know, to me, the question originally was not who was going to win the race, but could the winner govern? And I think that still remains a critical issue. And if you look at the qualities that we normally need in a president, and one of them that's very, very important is judgment. It's a capacity to make a decision that is a well-informed decision that takes into account history, the consequences for the future, and that sort of thing. If you go back to Kennedy and the missile crisis in the 21 days, or 13 days, that, you know, he displayed exquisite judgment, because the first conclusion reached by his team was we ought to go bomb Cuba. You know, we ought to have a strike out of the blue because they had these missiles sitting there. And then he let the process go on, and people changed their minds. So the first consensus gave way to a second consensus, which actually saved us from an atomic war, because no one knew at the time that the Russians not only had missiles on the ground, but they had nuclear tips on the missiles. They were already armed missiles. And as McNamara used to say out here in Aspen, Robert McNamara, Had we hit them, if we bombed them, we wouldn't have taken out all their missiles on the first strike. They would have fired those missiles at Washington and Miami nuclear, and we would have had Washington incinerated, and then there would have been no choice on the part of the president but hit back at Moscow, and we would have had a nuclear war. And we escaped that because of good judgment. And these things matter. And I think for good judgment, experience matters. I think a sense of history matters. You know, a sense of perspective matters. Having people around you who are mature and can be thoughtful. And I think Hillary fulfills all of those. I think she checks all of those boxes. Yeah, she's been wrong from time to time. You know, there's no question about that. And I very much regret that we can have John Kerry standing up here and being eloquent about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this is something Hillary supported for a long, long time, and now she's against it. I mean, that to me that's a distressing sign. But nonetheless, overall, I think she hits the judgment thing. The second thing, you do need a sense of where you're trying to go. You do need a sense of vision. A leader has to have a destination, something you're trying to, a problem you're trying to solve by having, and then you have a strategy and you have the tactics to get you there. And on that, I think that she's very good. And I think in particular, for example, where one of her strengths will be that the empowerment of women around the world. And women and children have been, that it is a very authentic part of what she is. There are pieces of Hillary you sometimes wonder, is this really her or not? But on this issue, she really cares about it. And I think that can make a substantial difference. To put that at the heart of American foreign policy, as she's been unable to do as Secretary of State, but I think running your own team could do that. But the third issue, the third quality, is one that in his biography of Truman, David McCullough concluded was the most important quality for a president, is character. And I think there she has work to do. And I think she knows it, and she's admitted as much recently. And she's got to become a model of transparency over the next months. You know, she's got to be willing to do whatever needs to be done, obviously, about the emails. But I believe she needs to face up to the questions and the doubts about the Clinton Foundation, because there are substantial doubts, and the right is now starting to feed those doubts. They've got to do a white paper. I've talked to Donna Shalala about this. I don't think there's anything wrong there. They may have some embarrassments, but I see no evidence at all that they've crossed any criminal lines or violated any laws. But I think they need to sort of complete on that, in effect. And I would say that's true of the speeches she's given to Goldman Sachs and things like that. In other words, I think she has to build trust as quickly as she can, because trust is so important to getting people to do things they're not sure they want to do. You know, leadership for centuries, leadership was about the leader bringing a top-down sense of things. You know, you must do this or you're going to pay a price. If you don't do this, I'm going to cut your head off. I'm going to put you in prison, or I'm going to take this away from you or that away from you. It was all sort of enforced from the top down, and the corporate world, it became, you don't do this, you're going to get fired. That's not the leadership world we live in anymore. It's a much flatter organizations. And today, if you're going to mobilize people, you know, leadership is, I think the best definition of leadership is someone who mobilizes others in the pursuit of shared goals. And for that, the leader must have a continuing conversation in which you're listening, you're speaking, but it's back and forth, and you develop, in effect, a bond of trust that allows you to go forward. And people will then do some things that might be a lot tougher. And for her, she's got to regain trust. I just think it's so essential for in terms of the qualities of what she brings her. It's just going to be a much more difficult presidency. But I want to go to one other thing about her first 100 days, 200, 300 days. One of the big issues about governing in the next year or two is, are the Republicans going to be willing to let her govern? Are they going to be willing to work with her? Or are they going to try to, what they did to Barack right from the start, was try to bring him down? I think the Republican Party is in sufficient trouble that it should try to play a more constructive role, at least up until the first midterm elections, or, you know, for the first year and a half, there should be a window. But she herself has got to make a difficult decision on substance, and that is, do I reach out and try to make this a bipartisan year, which means I've got to break bread with the Republicans and I've got to get them to compromise, but I've got to compromise. But if I do that, I'm going to catch hell from the Sanders wing of the party. How does she deal with the fact that the left has become a critical part of her alliance for getting into power? How does she square that with governing and trying to work with Republicans? I'm not sure, but I will tell you, I think that's going to be a challenge. And, you know, there are going to be people nipping at her heels from every angle. And she's tough. She's tough. But this is a tough, tough challenge. The next few years are not going to be easy years. It's going to be, some hard things have to be done. And, you know, I from my point of view, whoever gets elected, I want them to succeed. I come from a fraternity of people who've had a privilege working in the White House. And I can tell you, if you do that, you come to the conclusion it's really important that our president succeed. Even if you don't agree with everything they believe in, the country is served much better if people can govern and get things done. And we desperately need some things done.
We're going to go in just a moment to questions from all of you. And we have microphones that are going to be on both sides of the aisle. But I just want to, it's not even a question, I just want to pose a situation to you. We seem to be in something that is functionally a forever war. Mm-hmm. And I've been myself to Afghanistan quite a bit. And I mean, in a war that when I was first there, people referred to it as, it's been at war for 23 years. This country finally, it was actually referred to for a couple of years as finally peaceful after 23 years. But now it's 37-year war over there. What's needed there, do you think, in a president?
Well, I think the next president will inherit the most complex set of problems in foreign policy that any president has had. They're not of the existential variety we faced, you know, with the nuclear bombs hanging over our head in the way they have. But clearly, the world is moving very rapidly and in many cases in the wrong direction, and democracies. You know, progress is not inevitable. We a lot of us grew up with the Enlightenment thing, and progress was just sort of built into Western civilization. And it's possible to go backwards. And if you look at the number of democracies at the end of World War I versus the end of World War II, there was a dramatic drop in the number of democracies. And we are now in a situation where many, many nation states are in deep trouble. They're corrupt. They're not responsive. They're bailing out of a system. The whole, you know, Walter Isaacson, in the beginning of this whole Ideas Festival, I mean, made a major statement that the age of globalization is over. You know, the forces that were bringing nations together in cooperative ways through institutions like the EU or maybe it was NATO or other, a lot of those, they're disintegrative forces at work. And so it's not just the particular problem that you face, but I think it is you're working against trend lines now that are very dangerous. And so I think that's going to take a lot of the attention of the next president, but it's going to be particularly important because we also have domestic issues that are very, very pressing. I think it's particularly important for Fitz Hillary to choose someone she truly entrusts with running foreign policy, to not try to run foreign policy out of the White House. I think one of the mistakes in the Obama administration, they've done a lot of things right, but I think they have not given their Secretary of State and their Defense Secretary sufficient latitude to do a lot of the big things that needed to be done. I think they were trying to run too much, and I have a lot of respect for Susan Rice, who was here as a policymaker, but that's a tiny little group of people inside the national security offices. And what you really need is to be able to employ the full resources. And a lot of the best, the experts, the people who speak the languages and know the cultures, are over at the State Department. They're not at the White House. And so you really want to be able to mobilize the full resources of the State Department and build up the diplomatic arm of you know, people. A lot of people think, well, she'll just be her own Secretary of State. That'd be a mistake. She's got so much work to do if she's the president that I don't think she can afford to do that. Now, clearly, the Middle East does not pose an existential threat, but the threat of ISIS. I thought John Kerry was a little optimistic this afternoon about ISIS, how much progress we've made against ISIS. I mean, there's no question we're on the offensive in Syria and Iraq and have taken back some territory. But the head of intelligence just testified 2 weeks ago that the threat has not subsided. The danger are just as much today as they were, especially of lone wolves. And what we saw, just heard about in Istanbul, 28 now dead, or the number keeps rising, shows how vulnerable we are. And two or three more kind of terror acts in the United States by lone wolves will have this country on its ear in terms of civil laws and restrictions and what we face. And I think it will distort our values a lot. So the next president has to be, I think, forceful on that. And I will tell you, I think if John Kerry had his complete freedom, we'd have a lot more boots on the ground right now. We'd be really going after Assad. We'd be weakening Assad in order to get the Russians to come to the table and try to get a peace deal. And those are calls presidents make. And he said we're working on it. And I think he's been a very good Secretary of State. Very good. And he's like unbelievable Iron Man. But the next president, I think, is going to have to really get this problem under control and to really make the pivot that Obama talked about earlier. It is important that we spend more time on the Chinese relationship. But probably the larger issue for the next president is, how do you ignite economic growth? How do you create the jobs, not only in this country, but in other countries, so that you don't have, millions of young men wandering around with nothing to do, no jobs, no future. Women won't get involved with them because they're, they have nothing to offer. And you've got a frustrated 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, or even younger, who are just out of control. And it's in our national interest to try to get the global economy moving faster. And what Christine Lagarde is facing, how do you get the growth rate up? There is a very, very serious danger that the new normal is going to be slower growth than what we're seeing now. And I think that, trying to come to grips with that, trying to figure that out, we as Americans can be take heart in the fact that we remain the most innovative people in the world in terms of big countries. There's no other developed country that is as innovative as this country, and is so much on the cutting edge of so many new industries. I don't know if you heard Alec Ross, who's been here this week, talking about the industries of the future. But if you go after, if you look at whether it's energy or you know, digital revolution or life sciences, where so much is going on right now, you can go through the list, and we're right there at the forefront. But our scientists will tell you, we're not investing enough in science. We, in fact, have slowed down. It's much harder to get an NSF grant than it used to be. People who used to get their first NSF grant in their late 20s, now they're sometimes in their 40s before they get any. So when they're at the prime of their creative genius, when they need the money, and it's not there for them. You know, we've cut back on a lot of that. I was with a Nobel Prize winner at Yale 3 or 4 years ago, and he had just won the prize. And he was a result of 30 years of work, of research. He just won the prize. And a week before he won the prize, he got a call from the government saying, we have budget stringencies. We've got to cut your funding in half. He's one of the best scientists in the world. And we can't afford to support his science. That's not. So I think the next president has got a very, very big agenda to figure out, how do we get people back to work, and how do we bind up the wounds? How do we create a civil society in which people are more civil to each other? I think there is a lot of work to be done. One of the earlier panels, I said, look, what we need for young people, developing these human resources, go back to the two most successful social programs we've ever had, which did so much. One was the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, that Franklin Roosevelt proposed in the spring of 1933 when he'd just been inaugurated. And by that summer, this is some measure of how slow we are these days, by that summer we had 250,000 young men in the woods working, getting a dollar a day, but they were working, and they were getting meals, and they had a job. It was really important. Over 9 years, we had 3 million people go through that program, the most popular program of the New Deal. It was marvelous successful. And look at the other one, the GI Bill. Yeah, after World War II, we had 16 million veterans coming out of World War II. 7.8 million veterans went back to school on the GI Bill. We increased by 50% the number of people going to college. We created the middle class out of the GI Bill. It was wonderfully successful. In both cases, we didn't give people something. We said, if you serve the country, you'll be compensated. If you do something for the country, we'll compensate. That's what national service is all about. That's why so many of us who come here to Aspen keep saying we need national service so that every young person is expected to give at least a year back to the country, maybe 2 years, and then we ought to forgive them their college loans for that. Let's not send them free to college. Let's say, we're going to give you the opportunity, but you've got to have some responsibility. You got to do something to get it. It's not just going to be free. That encourages a culture. If it's all free, it encourages an irresponsible culture. Now, people say, well, it's too expensive. You can't do it. There is money out there. Among other things, you don't have to spend a lot of new money in doing this. We have internet. Our corporations have now got at least $1 trillion piled up overseas. By some accounts, it's $2 trillion. Many of them want to bring it back, but because of our tax laws, they don't want to pay the much higher taxes. We're the highest corporate taxes in the world. You can cut a deal with the corporation. Look, we're going to let you come and bring it back at this reduced rate, but in exchange for that, we want money to train and put to work our young people. So get them into vocational training, get them into whatever, but have it for that service program, and you can pay for that program out of that money that's overseas. There are ways to do this. But what we need, and what the next president has to do, is find ways to bring us together on projects, on programs that excite people, that have a sense of freshness, and get us thinking, stop talking and start doing more. You know, let's have action. We talk and talk and talk, but we really need action.
We're going to give you a chance to talk for just a moment. Yeah. We have about 10 more minutes. Yeah. Let me just, I'll pick the lady sitting right there with a white shirt on. Sorry. There's actually quite a few people.
Hi.
Thank you very much. We have managed to get through this entire discussion of electability without mentioning race or gender.
Race or gender.
Right. I think that many of the people's response to Donald Trump is in direct response to Barack Obama. And then I also believe that many of the responses that people are having towards Hillary Clinton is because she's a woman. Is there any validity in that, or am I just seeing ghosts?
No, I think obviously implicit in the idea that Hillary Clinton is going to be elected, as that addresses a gender question that's been hanging over us for a long time. And I actually believe she seriously ought to consider Elizabeth Warren, partly because I think it'll, you know, excite the base, but I think it actually would be interesting to have two women running. Now, there's a lot of dangers in doing that. I appreciate that. I doubt she'll do it. I imagine she'll go to a safer choice. But look, I think this has got to be a set of solutions that are not defined by race and gender. I think there's got to be a set of solutions that are defined by we're all in this together. And of course, we want, especially in the criminal justice system, the inequities in that system have got to be cleaned up. There's no question about that. But one of the basic ways you're going to deal with the problems of the prisons in this country is to get young people working who don't have his time on their hands, and then they get into drugs and one thing and another, and they make these mistakes in life, and they get into terrible trouble. That's part of solving the criminal justice system as well. I'm just saying, I don't think it ought to be an agenda. I think it ought to be a national agenda in which race and gender and other issues like that are treated with great fairness and great respect. But my preference would be to have a program that's for all Americans. Because, you know, frankly, you know, one of the problems we have with these Trump voters, the blue-collar voters who are going for Trump, is they think the system is rigged for everybody else but them. You know, they think that the rich have rigged the system for them. The Republicans have rigged it to make sure that people protect people at the top. And they think the Democrats have rigged it to favor minorities and to favor people at the bottom. And there's nobody thinking about them. And we need to bring them into this set of solutions as well. That's my personal preference. I hope that addresses. Say, okay, please. There's a microphone still. Why don't you leave it up here? We've got a cluster of two or three people here, and then we can. Is there another microphone over here?
There's another one.
And we'll come
there.
This way in just a second.
And there's folks over there, too.
I was concerned about, I would like to see Hillary get elected. There are numerous Republicans who are friends and so forth who are, just as they were, very much opposed to Obama. They are very much opposed to Hillary, would not vote for her under any circumstances. So I've said to them, I'm not asking you to vote for Hillary. Just don't vote for Trump. Now, I'm not sure that works, and I was curious for your reaction, because I noted yesterday one of the polls that came out that while she is ahead by 6 as an average, when you include Johnson and I can't think of the other lady, she's only ahead by 1. So it looks like the minority candidates are taking away from her much more so than him. And if I say to my friends, just don't vote, in effect what I'm saying,
sure.
I wonder if that would hurt hers more than him.
Well, the early polls suggest that the Libertarians, and it could hurt her more than him. Typically in an election, that third party candidate shrinks in strength because everybody realizes that person's not going to win, and then they go elsewhere. The big issue right now is whether the Libertarian candidate can make it into the first debate. If that happens, that's a threat to her. Under the rules of the debate, you got to have 15%. And so far, Gary Johnson is nowhere near 15%. His numbers could keep rising if the people you're talking about who feel disgruntled with both sides sort of say, well, he's my default candidate. It's out there. I don't think yet it's a pressing question for her. I think the more important question for her is, how does she build up the enthusiasm of the young people? You know, how does she make sure, if you see that Brexit went down because the young people, because the young people didn't vote, they were all for staying, but they didn't vote. Now, Democrats really ought to take that to heart. I mean, you know, if you've got a candidate in Bernie Sanders who really excites them and Hillary does not, you got to deal with that. Otherwise, you could get in real trouble. So I think right now she needs to pay attention to the main pillars of her campaign and get those stronger. And then the Gary Johnson thing, I think, recedes into past. But there are a lot of Republicans who do not like her at all. But it's interesting the number of Republicans who are starting to break off And, you know, he's going to have a, it's going to be really, really interesting to be in Cleveland for the convention and see if, in fact, what kind of people are going to be up there on stage demonstrating enthusiasm for him. It may be a very different cast of characters. It may be a lot of former athletes, for all we know, or entertainers. But, you know, a lot of people are not going. What's that? A lot of people are not going. Barbara Bush was here yesterday. Laura Bush was here yesterday. Thank you. Laura Bush was here yesterday, and she said she and George W. are going to go to the ranch for July, except for one time, and when they're going to leave, to be with Bill Clinton. What?
I believe she said she was going to vote for Hillary, Laura Bush.
I haven't heard her say that.
Be careful, but...
I haven't heard her say that.
No, or
but
she would support him.
Who knows? But when Hank Paulson came out, you know, to be Treasury Secretary, and I thought he was a very good Treasury Secretary, and said, I'm not voting for Trump, that was pretty significant. One question, more questionnaire will come here. Yes, ma'am, right here. And then can somebody bring the microphone right up here, the other microphone? Yeah, right, you've got it over there, please. Go.
Hi, my name's Julie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question to you is, you touched a little bit on if Hillary Clinton was elected, the challenges she was going to face, both from Bernie Sanders and from the Republicans. Can you talk a little bit about what would happen if Donald Trump was elected? And he basically doesn't have anybody to answer to. What happens?
I don't know. We're in unknown territory, I think, if that happens. We'll wait and see. If he starts and he can consistently do this, be a more orthodox, quote, presidential candidate, the threat of Donald Trump will grow for Hillary. You know, I don't know whether he can get there. The early impressions are so bad. I mean, right now you've got 70% of the country doesn't approve him. 70% actively disapprove of Donald Trump. 77% of women. 88% of Hispanics. 92% of blacks. You're in a country where the Republican candidate, in order to win, needs 40% of the Hispanic vote. That's the conventional wisdom. Right now, Donald Trump only has 12% of the Hispanics who approve of him. So I think the chances of him making it are still quite slim, absent some big blockbuster kind of event, which we do not know about yet. Now, what if happens if he gets there? I don't know. There's going to be a real trouble putting together a government. A lot of the people who might otherwise want to work for a president, and, you know, the number of people waiting to work for Hillary is, it's quite a long line. It stretches out well beyond the Pepke over here. I can't tell you the number of friends I have who said I won't do that. I just don't want to be in that boat. I don't want the reputation, and I think it'll be too uneven, and it's going to be. So it's going to be. I argue to people, look, if Donald Trump comes and asks for a briefing at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's nominated the Republican Party, you should give him a briefing. It's for the sake of the country. You know, go to the Belfer Center at Harvard and get a briefing, you know, and have Graham Allison and Joe Nye, all these people sit down with you and do that. That's really, really important. I think that part of it is not hard. Having people like that come and work for you is going to take a lot of work. He's got an uphill fight to get the best, to get the really qualified people. And so far, you know, he's talked to Jim Baker, he's talked to Henry Kissinger, but he doesn't have anybody that the rest of the foreign policy community recognizes as a heavyweight on his team. You know, and you, same thing is true in finance. So this is there are days of reckoning coming on some of this stuff that are pretty serious. Let's go over here.
Thank you very much, and thanks for this, all your insights. I've been listening to you for years and appreciating them. If Hillary Clinton gets elected, what do you think is a bigger existential threat to our country? Is it international terrorism, or is it a dysfunctional Congress? And what I'm saying is there anything that Hillary could do possibly to avoid the, you know, basic, you know, stalling tactics and everything that Barack Obama faced?
I know, I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear, but did you hear that?
Just the very end, I missed the basic.
I was asking you first, is international terrorism or congressional dysfunction a bigger existential threat
number one. And number, because you were talking about how the, you know, the fact that governments aren't working is part of what's going on around the world.
Yeah.
Well, and number two, what could Hillary do if she got elected to avoid what happened to Barack Obama, which is that they basically stonewalled him?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think Republicans are going to have a much stronger self-interest in trying to work constructively with Hillary for a year or two or a year and a half, simply because they've got to restore their own reputations. I mean, this is a party that's been badly hurt by this whole episode with Trump. Look, if I had my druthers, and this is probably fantasy world, but I would look back at what John Kennedy did when he was elected, and he knew he didn't have the support that he needed, the confidence levels he needed in national security and in economic affairs. And what did he do? He reached out and got a Republican, Douglas Dillon, to be his Treasury Secretary. He asked Robert McNamara, a Republican, to be his Defense Secretary. He got Alan Dulles, a Republican, to run the CIA. He got a Republican who was a professor of Harvard, dean at Harvard, Mac Bundy, to come into the White House and be his National Security Advisor. He got a Republican to be the Ambassador to Germany. He got a Republican to be the Ambassador to Vietnam. I would love to see, I believe Hillary would get further with that approach, but if she does, she's going to have hell to pay with a lot of the Sanders people. And so I think that's the question. How do you balance these off so that she can govern successfully and get things done? She doesn't have a shot in hell of getting things done if what she brings to Congress and says, here's what it is, I'm not compromising, here's five things that my friend Elizabeth Warren have given me, and here's what we're going to do. You know, that's going to bring dysfunctionality. It's going to take two to tango here. So I would rather see her, for the sake of the country, do that. But I cannot stress enough, I do think that the Sanders people have a legitimate claim to have a serious voice in the next administration. I think that they have earned it, and they have demonstrated their ability. But how you reconcile the two things, I think, is really hard. There's another question over here. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
We have like about one more minute, I think.
Fine, that's good.
Quick question.
You're great. Thank you. A quick question. With that attitude about Republicans, what if she chose John Kasich for her running mate in Ohio? That was one of the proposals in the New York Times on Sunday.
Well, listen, I happen to think if Donald Trump can get John Kasich, that would be terrific. I was one who believed from the first this would probably wind up being Hillary versus Jeb. And my own feeling was, if that were the case, I would be able to sleep well at night because I knew whoever got elected, the country would be in reasonably safe hands. And I do think that John Kasich has been a good governor of Ohio. The growth rate there has improved substantially. He's got the jobs are coming there. It's a well-managed city. Columbus is a great city right now, just named one of the smartest cities in the country. And so having someone like that do it, and he might just do it. He might just do it. Again, you have to worry about how do I negotiate with my friends Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. You know, the most likely choice for Hillary is Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia. What's the knock, and why are the Bernie Sanders forces already starting to oppose him? Because Tim Kaine is for the Trans-Pacific Partnership that John Kerry is for. And that is regarded as makes him unqualified or disqualified from being vice president. That is what she's up against. You know, that she's got to sort of find ways to continue her relationship and see that as her base. Republicans have had to do this to some extent in the past, you know, because there's been this really right-wing faction that's been out there for a long time. And, you know, a Republican like even a Ronald Reagan, but certainly George H.W. Bush, had to be very, very careful what they did with that far-right contingent. And she's going to, it's not going to go away. They share a lot of the same frustrations the Trump voters have, and they come from many of the same places. So it's, I will say this, that when she first came to Washington, and I knew them, I had the privilege of working and being with the Clintons on a number of occasions before that, and then he asked me to come in and help him 6 months in, and when they came to Washington, he had almost pitch perfect ear for politics, And he didn't know how to govern in the Washington sense. He, you know, he'd been in a much smaller sandbox. But he was bright. He was very bright, and he had a really pitch-perfect ear. She did not. I mean, she had a tin ear for politics. Yeah, she didn't get it. She didn't like it. She was very unhappy. She was like, it was very tough for her in the beginning. And she got battered several times. That's one of the reasons. She's more vulnerable as a human being than people think, but she's created this zone around her, this armor to try to protect herself in many ways. But she's a much, much better politician today than she was in 1993. I mean, she's developed a much clearer sense. I happen to believe she was an excellent senator. To me, that was the finest period of public service she's had because she was on her own. She worked really well. She worked and played well together across the aisle. You know, she could have been the majority leader of the Senate. I mean, that's the path she was on. Her colleagues liked her. Republicans respected her. And if that's the Hillary who shows up as president and she can be herself like that, I think that could be things could be a lot brighter than they now seem. Yeah, that's great. I agree with that absolutely. Renee, over to you.
David Gergen, thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Good. Okay.
This is Aspen Public Radio. You've been listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. You can also find this discussion later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Corporate support for the Aspen Ideas Festival broadcast on Aspen Public Radio is provided by Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations through its offices in Aspen and Denver. From Greenline Architects in Carbondale, specializing in designs from residential, commercial, and agriculture buildings. Whether your project is high-end or affordable, Greenline listens to you and designs for your needs. More at greenlinearchitects.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station.